Salutations, Mets fans, and welcome to this week's edition of For All You Kids Out There, a Mets Adjacent Baseball Prospectus podcast. I'm your host, Jeffrey Paternostro. With me once again this week is Jarrett Seidler. Jarrett, we're recording on Monday because it is the day after Super Bowl Sunday, and a pretty good Super Bowl Sunday for former Mets reliever and your poker buddy, Pat Mahomes Sr.
I played poker with Pat Mahomes at the Borgata about I've told this story on the podcast.
Probably more than once.
Probably five years ago or whatever. Yeah. He's a nice guy.
Yeah. He seems to be having the time of his life, which is good for him.
Yeah, I'm sure he
I watched the second half. Like, I don't watch a lot of football, but I watched a lot of football from, 2004 to 2013 or so. I don't know.
Yeah, this game probably looked a lot more like a college game than a pro game from that time.
It does,
period.
But so I've I'm on Twitter.com, and I get the discourse comes across my timeline. So there's been a lot recently about Joe Burrow being a real quarterback and Pat Mahomes being just like, I forgot the actual term people are using, but. An athlete, for the lack of a better term. An athlete that plays quarterback.
There's a word for
there
that.
There is, yeah.
It's called racism.
But also, like, watching this game, and since I haven't watched a ton of football, I've watched both the Mahomes Super Bowls before this one. I certainly watched the Niners one.
Yeah.
I don't remember if I watched the Tampa Bay one or all of it, but regardless, this is, like, one of the best pocket passers I've ever seen.
Patrick Mahomes at his peak right now is the greatest quarterback in NFL history. Now, I have no idea if he's going to have a 22-year peak like Tom Brady did, but he has already surpassed Brady's extreme peaks in the late 2000s and the mid-2010s.
So this is going to be...
And that's not even close.
As a Niners fan, this is going to be like... dude that's only seen Boss Baby getting real Boss Baby vibes, but it's like he goes through his reads like Montana, but then if you get to him, he has like not Steve Young's mobility, but he has that kind of scrambling ability to make plays with his legs too.
Well, he usually has Steve Young's mobility
when they're not like, I don't know what they gave him at halftime, but it seemed to work.
As I remarked to Kate, he was like watching Patrick Mahomes play quarterback in slow motion. He was still the Super Bowl MVP, of course. Look, the guy's better than... I don't...
But he does everything you would want your quarterback to do well, right?
And then some.
And then some, yes.
He's
5 years into his career. He's won 2 MVPs, 2 Super Bowls, made a third, like...
He's the most accurate passer in the league. He's got one of the best arms. He's one of the best runners. He's the best improviser.
Yeah, he's capable of making absolutely spectacular plays. Yeah.
Right. He does all kinds of crazy shit. People are going to listen to this podcast, especially, they're going, what about Brett Favre? What about Fred Hardin? Yeah. This is I made this point with baseball videos recently, but if you actually like go back and watch like Brett Favre from the mid-90s, like it looks like everything's in slow motion.
Right. Going further back than that, I was watching, this was a few years ago now, I was getting lunch with my father at Buffalo Wild Wings. I don't know if he was in the neighborhood, probably the one by my office, yeah. I don't know if he was in the neighborhood or something, and they had the Niners, Cowboys, the catch, the championship game on. And yeah, it was so slow. Everyone, like, it's almost like watching a rugby game, right? Everyone kind of wrapped up, and there was just a ton of space to play with. And it just felt like, I don't know, there was no pace to it, right? Like, you watch
in the gap in between the championship series and the World Series, MLB Network replayed the 1980 NLCS between Houston and Philadelphia. I think it was 1980. That's only 40, at the time it's 42 years ago. So, two generations of baseball players back. Yeah. Like, there are Albert Pujols played with guys who played with guys in those games.
Yeah,
right?
And, you know, it's also, it's still, I guess some teams are probably still using a four-man rotation then, but it's, like, closer to a five-man rotation. It's closer to modern relief usage as well.
This is what you can say, you know, 1980 is generally considered part of the modern era of baseball.
Mm-hmm.
The only player on either team, and this includes Hall of Famers,
yeah.
The only player on either team that would have remotely looked correct in a 2022 baseball game is Balmerat.
Yeah.
The only one.
Yeah, who is like a historical freak during his era.
Outlier, outlier, everything, right? So, like Pete Rose?
It was older Pete Rose, but yes.
Right, but, you know, Pete Rose looks like an Oregon guy in this context.
Like Mike Schmidt,
right?
Who's probably the best third baseman of all time.
Mike Schmidt's bat in the fucking 2023 National League would be really fucking slow.
Yeah.
Like, really fucking slow. And I know people don't want to hear that, but the great... And you can tell... This is all Bill James' point.
Mm.
You can tell because... Outside of technology, this isn't technically true in, like, swimming because of certain technological things that then got banned. But anything, any sport where you're measuring against the clock, where the rules have stayed relatively constant and there hasn't been huge amounts of doping, the best times are always getting better. They're all, those world records are constantly getting beat.
Yeah, there was, like, Mark Spitz's times wouldn't have, like... It was like gold medal winning times wouldn't have qualified for Olympic qualifying like three Olympics later.
Right. Now, there's specific things where, like, that's not technically true in all aspects of track and field.
Right, the Bob Beamon record lasted forever, and the Michael Powell record lasted forever after that. But, yeah.
But they got brought. So there's outliers, you know, in cycling, some of, if you consider. Right, but, like, there's huge amounts of, like, EPO doping and stuff like that. And even, and Tadej Pogacar and Jonas Vingegaard actually broke some of those records, which then caused them to get accused of it. You know, Wout van Aert has been breaking a lot of those time marks, and people are now accusing
them
of
just casually tossing the cycling names out there. Like, sure, buddy, whatever. I don't know who any of those people are.
But it's like how, if you're, we just have Bauman on the podcast to talk about this, right? If, you know, you're breaking Lance Armstrong and Floyd Landis' records that were...
Those are 20-plus years ago now at this point, right? Well, Landis is more recent.
Huge amounts of drugs.
Yeah.
Right, just took, like, huge amounts of drugs that theoretically pushed things past the absolute limit of normal human performance. And they're now getting broken. One of two things is happening. Either the pace of progress in training and anaerobic exercise and so forth has moved that far ahead in the intervening 20 years, or these guys are doping too. I don't know which one it is.
Right.
But the point
if anyone ever breaks Bonds' record, like, they're going to get accused of it, probably, right?
Right, but the point is, in sports where you can measure against the clock, things are always getting a lot better quickly.
Right.
So it would stand to reason in sports where you can't measure against the clock, that's also true as well, that the best football is being played now, that the best baseball is being played now, that the best basketball is being played now. And you'll have old people talk about fundamentals and stats. But you can see this from, I'm going to switch this background to a baseball perspective. Think of all the advances in scouting, analytics, player development, outside development. Like, 10 years ago, like, exit velocity and spin rate weren't a thing. Like, they were just, like, that was, driveline was just coming into existence in that time period. Kyle Boddie was still, like, out there, like, on his own.
Commenting on, like, THT pieces.
Yeah, right. So, you know, in the, you know, the StatCast era is since 2015, and that's when a lot of stuff started being tracked in any kind of, you know, that's around when teams started putting TrackMan installations in their minor league fields. The teams that were on the cutting edge of that, 2013, 2014, so that's 10 years ago. And think of all the things we've done. When we, me and you were having a conversation with somebody that works in the industry this past week. Well, I was having it with them, and you were chiming in every 20 messages. But think of how recent. This is when we start. You started BP in 2015. I started in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
The first couple of years we were doing it, we thought downward plane on a fastball was good.
Right.
That was like the idea.
You guys will hit the top of the ball and hit grounders, right?
Yeah. Right. There are scouts out there that still think that.
Downward plane, uppercut swing, not a good combination.
Yeah, downward plane is bad on, like, almost every fastball except very specific types of sinkers. Mm-hmm. And most of the time, those types of sinkers get smacked. Like, there's outliers there, too. There's always outliers. You know, when I started doing this, the platonic ideal of pitching prospect was, like, downward plane and, like, this beautiful arcing curveball. And it turns out that makes for a really hittable fastball and a curveball that doesn't tunnel with it, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's like the Jesse Biddle problem,
right. And again, there are outliers, like Rich Hill would be an outlier in this case for that kind of stuff, but yeah.
Right, those two pitches tended to eat up A-ball hitters, but when you got to the major
league, almost
like,
eat up A-ball hitters.
Right, you know, Victor Robles was considered some type of hit tool freak. Victor Robles didn't have anything that drove a hit tool particularly.
Yeah.
He was getting on base a lot in levels of the low minors because he was really fast and could kind of slash and burn the ball. That doesn't work in the major leagues unless you're Ichiro, as it turns out. And the guys who are outliers, and they tend to have outlier contact numbers. Yeah. They tend to have, you know, Jeff McNeil has an outlier hit tool, but he also has outlier contact metrics. Because those usually go together. If you have such incredible barrel control that you can aim the ball somewhere, you're generally not swinging and missing on balls in the zone a whole lot. Because those are interconnected skills.
You know, for a...
So it...
Go ahead.
No.
I was just going to say, for a Mets example of, like, the Jesse Biddle phenomenon, like, Colin McHugh dominated the minors with his... big, pretty 77-mile-an-hour curveball, and then, you know, until he basically got the hard slider. I mean, he had a slider in the minors, I think, like a slider cutter there in the Mets, but until the Astros tweaked it and he started leaning on it more heavily, he got knocked around in the majors a bunch. Literally, like, 2014. You're going to talk about the teams that were ahead of the game. Then,
Right. You know, you look at, I had a conversation once with Sean Doolittle about what his fastball did. And he's a VAA outlier.
Right.
He didn't know that when he started.
Right.
He converted from first base to relief pitching and was in the majors like 30 innings later. He wasn't training it to be a VAA outlier. That's how he threw his fastball when he was a two-way player at Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And if anybody had realized that at the time, he probably would have been a pitcher coming out of Virginia.
Right,
but
well, it's University of Virginia,
You know, for the majority of his career, he was an elite reliever throwing 88% to 90% fastball.
Yep. And not like...
And it was not a particular... It was not a particularly
like 97,
hard or spinny fastball. Yeah, it was... He made a bunch of all-star teams. He won a World Series. He's made a lot of money in the major leagues throwing a fastball that until 2 or 3 years ago, we did not have the ability to figure out why it was good.
Mm. Are you saying it's not an average fastball despite being in the average velocity band, Jarrett?
Gotta breathe in and breathe out. Yeah, I mean, look, there's still... Look, in the Baseball Prospectus guidebook, I didn't get it excised out to stop fucking measuring fastball by velocity alone until 2019 in our internal handbook.
Yeah.
The first two times I rewrote that handbook, I got pushback from people internally.
Mm-hmm.
And we were still, up until through the 2018 season, it was the official written policy of the Baseball Prospectus prospect team that you looked on a chart and converted fastball velocity to grade.
Yeah.
Can you believe that?
I mean, I was there, so yeah.
That was only 5 years ago.
I know.
Yeah, that was only 5 years ago. Now, was I doing that? No, of course I wasn't. You aren't it.
No. But, I was doing it more than you were. But
that was, right. You know, this was the... We go back to James Karinchak was the guy I used to break this because I was supposed to write up his fastball as a 6, and I wrote it as an 8, and it's just like, why the fuck am I writing it as a 6?
Yeah.
Well, it only sits 96 to 98, and the chart says that that's only a 6. Who's the guy you're – I forget. I know who you're subtweeting. I forget on what player. Was it Cooper Herpy?
It was Cooper Herpy, yes. Or Jerpy.
Right, you know. Yeah, like, you know, you think a 91-mile-an-hour fastball is a below-average fastball. Just because it's 91 miles an hour, it's below-average fastball velocity. It's not a fucking below-average fastball.
And, like, I wrote this in his blurb, like, 5 years ago, I would have been like, why the heck did the Cardinals pick this dude in the first round? He's a lefty reliever. It's like crossfiry, low arm slot. And that's like, oh, yeah. Nobody. And like, yeah, nobody can hit his fastball, but it's college. He's going to get to double A. And no, just nobody is going to hit his fastball.
Yeah, crossfire means you're a reliever.
Yeah.
We had this argument about Sam McClanahan when he came. Yeah, he's going to end up in it. He has relief mechanic. Well, why are they relief mechanic? Why can't they be starter mechanic? Because it doesn't look right?
I mean, he got hurt a fair bit, too,
you know,
when he was trying to start.
Fucking so. The A's just traded for J.J. Bleday.
They did.
There's three reasons people think J.J. Bleday could hit. One, because he was good in college 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Two, his swing's really pretty.
It is.
And three, because he was really good in a wacky offensive environment against gas table pitchers in the Arizona Fall League. But every fucking prospect writer and dynasty writer was out there and went, J.J. Bleday is back, baby!
Well, we should get back to our actual agenda.
The guy can't fucking hit!
He probably can't hit, no.
Probably. Whatever! He's never hit at any level of the minor leagues!
Mm-hmm.
On what basis can you not do his hit tool?
Again, Jared always says, like, I get what hyperbolic understatement is, and then I do it in the podcast, and it just sets Jared off all the time.
Give me the argument that J.J. Bleday has a four-hit tool.
I was not making that argument, Jared.
No, but that's what I'm saying. I want you to argue the other side of this to the best of your ability. Give me the argument that J.J. Bleday has a four or better hit tool.
This is episode 396 of For All You Kids Out There. We're doing athletics chat, I guess. Okay. My best argument that J.J. Bleday has a four-hit tool. Man, this is... is he not... He only got 200 and... For some reason, I thought he's played in the majors more than he has. But I guess he was only up last year. Let's see. I mean... All right. His zone contact isn't awful. His chase is pretty good. Yet his whiff rate is really high. That's interesting.
Yeah, look at his zone contact. Look at his Z swing, too.
Yeah, I mean, it's... His zone contact... Like, his contact when he chases is below average, but it's not, like... disastrous. I mean, the basic issue is this is the you know, the Zach Bean problem, the Robert Hassel problem. You know, the idea with Bleday coming out of college was he was going to maybe not hit for a huge average, but you know, they get a lot of Conforto comps, right? Like 250, 25, yeah. And he was 86-108 last year. He looks like he should be able to hit the ball hard, but he does not hit the ball.
Not only was he 86-108, but he was 86-108 swinging out of his shoes with a dead uppercut, which meant he popped the ball up all the fucking time. Yes, which means that his vertical... He is one of the few hitters in the major leagues who hits the ball too high.
Yes.
What was his average launch angle last year? It was in like the mid-20s.
25 on the nose.
Yeah, and his pop-up percentage was, like, one of the highest in the league.
It was 11%, which is not great. 11.5.
That's a severe understatement.
Yeah.
He's making a lot of... He is swinging out of his shoes and making a lot of weak, crap contact.
Yeah.
He is not making a lot of... You can, at 86-108 with a 25% degree launch angle, you can be making fucking happy zone contact all the time.
You're gonna
if you're hitting every ball exactly.
It's me 350 feet to the right center warning track.
Well, no, it's not even that. You can gap the ball all the time doing that.
Yeah.
That's not actually a bad. That's not necessarily a bad distribution of play. But your problem is you got to look a little deeper. And the percentage of balls he hits hard at a good launch angle is low. He also, you said his zone contact is fine. It's just fine. It's like league average.
It's a little below league average, but yeah.
Right. His chase rate's a little below league average. There's nothing actually driving it. Like, there's no. To hit major league pitching. Even an acceptable level, you have to do something well,
right?
Or you have to do everything pretty.
He does lots of things
below average.
Yes.
He does nothing well.
Well, you said made the argument he has a four hit tool. A four hit tool is below average.
Right, but to get to a four hit tool below, yeah, I knew you were going to make that with the argument. Yeah. I was saying this point. Read off his minor league averages per level at the levels he's played significantly at.
All right, hang on. I got to go to a different page for that. I will just point out he is whiffing at over 30% on every variety of offbeat pitch you could throw at him, too, which is...
Yeah, because he's trying to uppercut curveballs at the bottom of his zone to the moon.
Yeah.
That's the actual... This is the Jared Kelvin problem is the actual answer.
Mm-hmm.
He's basically the same hitter as Jared Kelvin.
All right, post-draft in 2019, he went to Jupiter, 257, 311, 379. 29 strikeouts and 151 plate appearances. And not what you want, but not awful. Also, he had hit 350 with power at Randy coming into that.
We had horrible reports on him.
We did post-draft, yeah.
Pro season. We faded him a little bit.
We did not fade him enough.
Yes, we did not fade him enough. Continue.
2020 was
a lost season. Yeah. We had horrible reports on him from the alternate site. We faded him a little bit more. We didn't fade him enough.
2021 at Pensacola, 212, 323, 373. So 23-year-old.
As a 23-year-old in AA who was a top five draft pick out of Vanderbilt, who was theoretically a polished major league ready college.
Then he went to the Arizona Fall.
That time we faded him exactly the right amount.
Then 316, 435, 600 in Arizona with almost as many walks as strikeouts.
We got a lot of shit on the public side for not having him in the 101 last year because everybody was hyping up that AFL performance. Folks, I could not give less of a shit about AFL performance unless you can tell me what looked different.
And then AFL quality
of pitching he was facing was substantially worse than the quality of pitching he was facing at Pensacola. And again, at this point, he now has 800 minor league at bats or whatever it is as a 20, he might have even been 24, as a overaged SEC major league, right? Yeah, he should hit in the Arizona Fall League. It would have been a really alarming flag if he did.
He went to Jacksonville this year, hit 229, 365, 470 with 100 strikeouts.
Which is still not particularly good.
It's very quad A-ish, right?
I saw
he hit for power. He hit home runs. Brilliant. He hit 20 home runs in a little over half a season. He's probably not seeing the quality of breaking ball he would see in the majors.
This man who has had an above average hit tool has not hit above 260 at any level in large sample sizes except for the fucking Arizona Fall League. How do you get to a good hit tool here? He doesn't hit. He doesn't make contact. He doesn't hit for power. He doesn't walk a lot. He strikes out all the time. Boy, his swing's fucking pretty, though.
We do have some actual Mets news to talk about. Not a lot, but Keith Hernandez signed a 3-year extension with SNY.
Whoa.
I guess all that subtweets, Winston Churchill subtweets, had the intended effect. I feel like this is always going to get done. I don't know when their first spring training game is, probably a couple weeks from now, but.
The only reason that Lincoln gotten done is Cohen doesn't control SNY.
Yeah.
So you've still got. Look, the Will Thompson and Keith have had problems. for sure. many, many.
I mean, are the willpower like how? I mean, like Comcast has a big share of SNY now too. I don't know how involved they are in the day to day kind of stuff. I don't either. Yeah,
I could absolutely have seen Jeff Wolfond getting his hand in the pot and trying to turf Keith to replace him with Todd Zeal or whatever. Yeah, I mean, I get this argument on Twitter once a year. Some fan, how can you support Keith Hernandez as a Trumper? He's a misogynist. He's this and this and that.
He's a Steve Forbes flat taxer, as I recall, but yeah.
Right. But hey, remember Mar-a-Lago.
He is, yeah.
That might all be true. There's a lot of people on your baseball team that have the same opinions. And, you know, Keith has mostly learned to shut up recently. A couple times a season, he says something that makes me cringe and makes you cringe. And they usually hit his mute button, and Gary comes back 20 seconds later in a horrified voice and moves on, right? As Ron's laughing. I've met Keith Hernandez a few times. I've met all three of them a few times. Gary is nice enough. Ron's a nice guy to have drinks with, and Keith is set up. He's a 70-year-old crankish former baseball player.
Yeah.
They weren't going to replace him with anybody better. You know, no Todd Zeal's political opinion still.
Sure. I mean, we know Vin Scully is, so yeah.
Right. No Gary's too. They're a lot better than Keith's. Don't know Ron's. Can probably guess.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's an entertaining broadcast crew. I worry. Look, it would have been really shitty for Keith going away to be, you know, kind of a.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is going to be his last contract, probably, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think this sets up the possibility for him to have a more fitting. Mm-hmm. You know, and he is a very meaningful part of franchise history as both a player.
And like all of them are going to be like pretty. Like, I don't know how long Gary wants to do this. A lot can happen in 3 years. Same with Ronnie.
Yeah.
So they might. Well, I don't know if they're all going to go out together. But yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this is one of those things where people like conceptually understand how good Mets fans have it, but there's going to be a day when they're going to be replaced by Wayne Randazzo and Todd Zeal, and it's going to be like, holy shit, I like Wayne Randazzo as an announcer. I think it's nice that he got the job in Los Angeles. I think he deserved the job in Los Angeles, but he's gotten a lot better. He did a real nice job on the Apple TV broadcasts that were generally a shit show. He was one of the few bright spots of the Apple
TV
broadcast.
He's one of those guys that does feel like he's a better fit for TV than radio in some ways, too.
Yeah, I did not like him when he started. He's gotten a lot better over the years, which is how this is supposed to go. But, yeah, I mean, we are certainly closing in on the end of this era of
Mets. It's
going to
be Keith Rad and Pat McCarthy on the radio, and both of whom are, like, well over a decade younger than me, which is funny. But
right, as long as Keith is relatively healthy and can make his drives in from Sag Harbor and do this with very little prep and workload, he's going to continue doing this.
Yes.
But the day is going to come when the money's not good enough to have that be a part of his life anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And, if you read between some lines, he may have been ready to walk away at this point.
Yeah.
That may have also just been negotiating posture.
Yeah, I mean, he's going to be like 72 or 70, you know, 71, 72 at the end of this contract. Like, that's, retire, man. That's fine. Pop in, do the Ralph Kiner on Sunday home games. And
you don't want these to get sad. Right. They can get sad if the guy goes too long. If any of these guys go too long, you know, you start seeing those stumbles on the air.
Yeah. Keith's still pretty sharp, to be honest, like as far as like game stuff goes.
Yeah.
I know he's a crank, but
yeah, he's a crank, and again, watching Mets games, you're in perpetual fear that Keith Hernandez is going to say something and get canceled. That's been true for 15 years.
Yes.
And, you know, I'm sure there's people who think that's part of the juice of it, right?
Sure.
What outrageous thing is Keith going to get away with saying this time? You know, and him being like the crotchety old man is also like his role on that broadcast, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Because Gary is very, Gary, as far as I know, doesn't listen to this podcast, but he does read Baseball Prospectus. He mentions this on the air pretty often. And Ron also pays attention to modern baseball. And, you know, for local broadcast announcers, Gary and Ron are very much in tune with modern baseball analysis. Surprisingly right. so for Gary, given his age and how long he's been doing this and that he's not.
Ron might not agree with all of it, but yeah.
Right.
He's aware of it.
You associate paying attention to this with people that are younger than me. You know,
literally Wayne Randazzo, right?
Yeah, Wayne Randazzo, Jason Benetti, younger announcers. But these guys, except for Keith, this booth has kept up very well on the trackings of modern baseball. So Keith kind of plays the back-in-my-day old fogey role. And he does that very well because it's not a role for him.
Right. Surely. But he's not as annoying as, like, John Smoltz either.
No, but he has interesting things to say. And instead of, he doesn't get into the, well, that's all wrong. John Smoltz thinks, and we're going to get back to the conversation at the beginning here. John Smoltz thinks that the best baseball was played in 1991. He thinks it's being played right now.
Right.
Keith
absolutely thinks he could still play today, right, in the modern era. That's the difference.
Right.
Because they'll say, like, oh, there's a lot more left-on-left changeups now, but I would love that. Yeah, like that kind of stuff.
Right. Keith thinks if you transplant 1979 Keith into 2023 training regimens,
he might just be Jeff McNeil, right?
Right. It's not that those guys couldn't play. It's that those guys in their context wouldn't. A lot of those guys, you take them and put them into today's context with the training and the nutrition and this and this and that, and they're going to excel too. Because it's not that they were innately less skilled or less athletic. It's just that we know a whole lot more about baseball and training, which is a different thing.
You know, it's possible Keith has a much longer career too.
Right, and Keith, I think, embraces that more than your John Smoltz,
right.
or, you know, going back a few years, like Joe Morgan used to be very, you know, that was the whole fire Joe Morgan craze with Mike Schur. So, you know, he's avoided being a character of a kind of old school back in my day guy, which is nice. I really like this booth. I don't think anybody listening to this podcast needs to explain that Gary, Keith, and Ron is a really good booth, but I do. You should enjoy these years while you have them, because at some point they will be gone, and the next thing that's going to come is almost immutably going to be like way worse.
Yeah. So. Wait, I don't even know who you would. Yeah. Well, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it.
It's Todd Zeal and some play-by-play. That's who they're grooming.
Yeah, I guess.
You know, you can see they're grooming Todd Zeal, they're grooming Anthony Recker, maybe they're grooming Jerry Blevins. Jerry Blevins has more interesting things to say than Todd Zeal or Anthony Recker, certainly.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're kind of building up that stable of ex-players that look good in a suit and talk good, but Zeal's the one that they keep giving the fill-in opportunities to, and I think that's probably a sign. That doesn't mean somebody else isn't going to hire Todd Zeal, and I think there's a pretty good chance the ownership of SNY changes before this happens. Because, you persistently hear in the background that Steve Cohen's trying to buy SNY.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know that that's going to happen, but I would expect that to happen at some point in the next few years. It just makes too much sense for everybody. The Mets should own that space, and they don't right now.
All right, let's do some correspondence. We have an email. I'm not doing the whole spiel. It's going to be a short episode. You know, it's 396. You know the deal by now. You know how to get in contact with us.
We're going to go back to a more normal recording schedule and more normal episodes next week.
Yeah, yeah.
Of the Super Bowl, just kind of mess things up this week a little bit. We'll start the positional previews soon.
Yeah, we got a lot of stuff.
We'll have spring training happening to talk about. There'll actually be stuff. Thank you to the listenership for bearing with us during our rough last 6 weeks or whatever the hell we're calling it. I don't know. The two of us have had like alternating like mental breakdowns, basically. Mm-hmm.
And a prospect list season. It's always lovely.
Yeah.
Email from Jeremy. As two of the world's foremost experts on Jeff McNeil, curious for your thoughts on this tweet. Tweet from Mike Petriello. One reason I'm so interested to see how rule changes play out is because I bet on this not actually being true for him. McNeil destroyed the shift last year at like plus 100 points of BABIP versus non-shift. He'll adjust, certainly. I'm just not buying definite win. And it's from an AP News article. McNeil, lefty batter, is a big league batting champion, likely to benefit from infielders repositioned back to where they were before the analytics era. When they do shift me, I just hit against the shift. When they don't shift me, I just hit. He said, when they do give me a giant hole somewhere, then I'm going to pad to get the ball through there and try to get my single. I mean,
like, I'm going to let you start the discussion on this one. Go ahead.
Well, like, if he's just he's just going to hit them where they ain't regardless, right? If he can do it against the shift, he's going to do it against the not shift. And if he's, you know, more likely to, it's not like he does it every single time, and it does give him more of a gap to his pull side. So maybe he tries to pull the ball a little bit more, and we can see, I wouldn't be shocked if he ends up hitting for more power because of that. Because he's
doesn't have to just try to
hit the ball into the, you know, into the shortstop hole or whatever. Go ahead.
Can you tell me what the definition of post hoc ergo prompter hoc is?
Yes. So it's the, you know,
after this, therefore, because of this, right. I find a lot of analysis.
It's hindsight is 2020. Yeah. So you don't want to use the Latin.
This is in fact setting up a high. Of course, Jeff McNeil is probably going to have his batting average go down. And of course, Jeff McNeil is probably going to have his batting average against shift opportunities go. That was going to happen anyway. He won the fucking batting title last year.
Yeah. He only hit 308, yeah. Let's see what's at the Facebook group. Something I did not pull up at him. All right. we didn't talk about this. So we can talk about this now. Cue for the P from Kyle. Is Bryn Alderson's dismissal a direct result of the Correa debacle? Seems to me like this move is from Cohen, and he is fed up with the process front office guys left over from the Alderson regime. Should we expect more front office shakeup? Well, you quoted West Wing. I am going to quote.
You're going to do House of Cards.
I am going to do House of Cards, the original. You might say that. I couldn't possibly comment. Look, you can read into the timing of various news items over the last 6 weeks related to the Correa contract and Mets front office move in any way you like.
I know too much about this.
I have faith in our listenership.
Make a snarky comment.
They are pretty smart.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, there's a lot of holdover people from previous two front offices. Epler is very clearly bringing in his own people. Cohen is very clearly bringing in his own people. And I think you're going to see people like Bryn Alderson and Mark Termuto, who have been here a very long time, probably shuffle out and go other places. I'm sure there's probably going to be more coming within that vein. This is natural when you have an ownership change and a front office change.
Yep.
The rest of it, I know way too much about to even make comments about. I mean, yeah, it seems suspicious, doesn't it, Jeffrey? Mac?
Cue for the P from Mike. How much does it cost for a minor leaguer to work with someone like Troy Tulowitzki in the offseason? I know Beatty has some kind of relationship with him from when he was committed to Texas, but I assume some money changes hands for that. Do you guys know how much driveline costs? Is it more for major leaguers than minor leaguers?
I am absolutely not answering this question. Feel free to email Kyle Boddy and get the answer to that. I will say Brett Beatty works out at the University of Texas. In general, college teams will what?
Yeah, it's good for recruiting. It's, you know, it's, yeah, it's
good for recruiting to have them around, yeah, et cetera, et cetera. I I have absolutely no idea how much Driveline is charging people at this point. Email Driveline if you want the answer to that.
Yeah, I don't. Tuolo's
worked in a volunteer capacity with the Texas baseball team. They got hooked up. Brett Beatty is from Austin, Texas.
He was committed there, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, so that's, you know, a lot of these. This varies a lot by training facility, the relationship that the player has with the training facility.
Right.
Some of these players work there in the offseason, work at these facilities in the offseason, too. So there's it depends. It really depends. It very heavily depends. It can be anything from nothing to thousands.
I mean, this is like the old, like, Pat Mazzucca was Jacob DeGrom's, like, offseason catcher because they both lived in the same area. Yeah. So,
yeah.
I remember a story. It was, so this goes way back to my Mason Avenue audio days. Somebody emailed me about, I was like friends with Robert Gazelman's high school coach or something, and mentioned that like Robert Gazelman and Akil Morris were like throwing partners in the offseason. So,
yeah.
You know, there's just a great, there's just a great article in The Athletic this week about, I don't remember what it was, like, about Adam Ottavino's warehouse in the,
Hack posted a YouTube blog that kind of goes with that article about the pitching lab.
Yeah.
You know, Adam, would you call Adam Ottavino the Pied Piper of New York doing like advanced? No, but he's been setting, like, he's been doing this for like years and years now.
At this point,
this
is back when he was still with the Rockies.
Bigger, Lindsey Adler wrote about this years ago, if I recall correctly, how he had just kind of like, or tweeted about it or something, how he had just kind of developed this, and as years go by, you know, more and more, you know, Adam Ottavino's friends make new friends, they show up, you know, Adam Ottavino's had success with this, people read about it in the paper and send them an Instagram message.
I mean, it's cool, there's like, just like random like, men's league dudes showing up too.
Right. This is my, again, I don't know Adam Ottavino at all, but my sense is that this is kind of like a very organic kind of thing that just kind of developed there. And it's cool. That's how this is. But there's levels of formality from that, or Brett Beatty working out at Texas, to guys doing an entire offseason program at Driveline or Cressy.
Yeah, I remember, like, IMG. I remember, again, back.
Yeah, IMG. IMG has this kind of stuff.
Yeah, Nimmo was, like, paying his own way to train at IMG when he was a prospect, which I noted that maybe the Mets should have their own setup for that, which they did not at the time because it was 2013 or whatever.
Well, then they started the Barra stuff.
They did,
basically making their own players pay for the Barra stuff.
Yeah, the company store thing, yeah.
Something that was always on the verge of erupting into a huge scandal and somehow never did.
Yeah.
Somehow it's because the baseball media never actually pushes this stuff.
Right.
I'm not actually saying somehow there. before people. Yeah. The registered name of that entity was Sterling Barwis. What other entities have Sterling in them?
Whatever.
I'm going to see here. A long time ago now.
It was.
But this is, you know, there's this kind of push and pull, give and take.
I mean, the teams are fine. I think the teams are generally fine with these guys doing third-party stuff because it takes, you know, they don't have to spend on.
They are now. A lot of them weren't 5 to 7 years.
Yeah, a lot of them have their own program. And there's already, like, dudes have been at spring training for what, like, two or spring training facilities for like 2 weeks now, 3 weeks in some cases.
Yeah, and if you want to, you can work out at the spring facility. You know? Yeah. Brandon Nimmo has been working out at the spring facility since like 2 days after he signed his contract.
Yeah.
There are year-rounders at spring facilities.
There are.
It varies wildly, depending on the person, what they're doing, and their relationship with that facility or organization. A lot of higher-paid major leaguers are just going to pick up the tab for this stuff for players that don't make quite as much, too. Like, again, I'm going to take a wild guess that Adam Ottavino is probably picking up the majority of the tab for the
right.
Carlin pitching lab, and Adam Ottavino makes millions of dollars in the major leagues, and Hack doesn't.
Right.
So that makes sense, right?
Yeah.
You know, that in some ways, some of these guys view that as their way of giving back to the baseball.
You know, it's a like a larger format version of taking the whole team out to dinner and putting some foosball tables in the locker room when you're on rehab or whatever, right? It's the same basic principle.
Yeah, you know, the St. Louis guys used to love when Jacob DeGrom rehabbed there because they'd get him, he'd like cater it with like Outback Steakhouse or whatever.
So I mean, it does vary, like on player development, you know, how directly the team's involved. Like sometimes, like we're at the point where a lot of these teams are just like, here's your off-season program. Like you can do it wherever you want. Here's what we want you to do. And sometimes there's consistent contact. Sometimes there isn't.
Yeah, it varies wildly. Mm-hmm. Some teams have specific relationships with some training groups and would like you to train with them. That varies too.
I will say, For the most part, the Mets have hired several Cressy people this offseason, but I feel like I've just seen like more of Cressy like around and about.
Yeah.
The last year or so.
I think that's because they're kind of... Look, the Mets over the last 18 months have gotten really into the driveline Cressy multiverse, right?
Sure.
They've hired a lot of people from the...
The spin rate cinematic universe,
Right. Eric Jagers has been a big driveline guy for almost as long as there's been driveline, right? So, what'd you call that? The spin rate.
Spin rate cinematic universe. We're right in the title for the episode. We're good now. Yeah.
So, it just varies, probably.
Yeah. We have any wrestling stuff?
Oh, talk about the genius Lanny Poffo.
No. I very, very vaguely recall that. Era of WWF superstars.
I recall, I watched it more than you did. I thought, genius was. Lanny Poffo was a really good kind of flippy wrestler in that period. Good personality.
Good heel bump guy.
Randy Savage's brother. Mm-hmm. Got paid in WCW and never worked for 4 years.
That thing that happened then.
Yeah. Got hired at WCW and hung out at home and tanned, and they never called him in and paid him for 4 years. It's one of the greatest achievements in wrestling history.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't watch Dynamite. I watched clips. The MJF promo was whatever they're doing WWE 2P, man. It's got the MJF promo and you got the Ass Boys winning the title on a bullshit
belt shot finish.
This is WWE Raw from 2008. Whoopee. They had a chance with MJF to get their top baby face, and instead they got Evolutionary Triple H. Good job.
Yeah.
Well done. Well played.
I'm sure the Iron Man match with Danielson will be really good, but...
I'm sure it will be. Do you give a shit? Are you even going to buy this pay-per-view? I don't think I am.
No. I'll see what the rest of the card is, but...
Yeah, there's nothing... I'm not feeling anything on this one.
Yeah.
It's a cold wrestling promotion. I know the matches are really good when I tune in. The matches are really good. I just don't give a shit about anything that's happening.
Here's the problem, right? So whatever, people are saying Okada, Shingo from New Beginnings like a 5-star match. Which, look, I believe it. There's like 35-star matches a year now by the old standard. Like it can't just be that.
Anyway. Yeah, not enough anymore. I've not gone back and watched Bryan Danielson versus Rus. I believe everybody that says it's the second best match of the year.
Mm-hmm.
So what?
Yeah.
I can pull up New Japan World for 999 yen and pull up 60% of the greatest matches in wrestling history. And without any context, that's what Bryan Danielson versus Rush is. It's, and the context doesn't make it better. It makes it worse.
Yeah, because they've done this gauntlet for your title shot thing like seven times already.
Right. And that, like that,
multiple times with MJF. Like at a certain point, I don't know, like just have the champion defend the title. Like it's not complicated, right? They're trying to make it. So I get that they don't want a heel authority figure or anything like that, which is fine, but.
So your two problems in terms of booking with the company is we don't have the top babyface guy. Well, you had Wardlow and you let it get through your fingers, and then you had MJF and you let it get through your fingers, and you probably could have Jungle Boy and you let it get through. Like, your failure to create a top babyface is because you keep fucking up and not pushing the guys who could be top babyface. They're about to do the same thing with Adam Cole.
Yeah.
So the fact that you don't have a guy... the guy is a failure of your promotion, and the fact that you don't have a heel tag team to wrestle the Acclaimed and had to make the Guns is because you didn't build the heel tag team. This is a problem. This is not so you do bad bullshit to cover your problems.
You could have done this with the House of Black and it would have been okay, I guess. At least they're on TV a lot and given attention and angles and stuff. I don't love, they're fine in the ring. They're better than the Guns, so.
So now you've got people hoping that they're just doing the before the pay-per-view title flippity-floppity that makes no sense and cools everybody, because the alternative is that they took the titles off the Acclaimed to get them to FTR, who themselves could have been the guy 6 months ago but are now is called. In large part because they were feuding with the fucking Ass Boys.
Right.
Right. This is all. Yeah, this is all an intermingled problem. That doesn't mean it's not bad. It's not a good wrestling show. And if you just love watching a good wrestling show or good wrestling matches happen in a vacuum and the storylines generally make sense, God bless. It's just not the show for me right now. And I keep trying. And every time I keep trying, I just get more frustrated with the product. So, I don't know.
Hopefully this was the show for you from a podcast standpoint. But if not, regardless, we'll be back next week with another edition of For All You Kids Out There.